This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on Radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. You know, last week we shared a conversation with Randy Hatzenbuehler, the president of the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation, and we talked about the history and future of one of the state's summer destinations. Today, we return to Medora to talk with the foundation's marketing and communications director, Justin Fisk. I sat down with him to talk about the people who work at Medora, and we met in the foundation's new headquarters called the Life Skills Center.
We're on the south side of the tracks in Medora, sitting in our Life Skills Center, proudly supported by Bill and Jane Marseille. This is really the hub for about 350, almost 400 seasonal employees in the summer. We've got a full-time staff of about 50, where most of them work here in the Life Skills Center. And from there, the staff spreads out working in restaurants and retail, and they come from all over the place, all over the United States and 10-plus countries around the world.
Well, we met somebody from Ukraine, somebody from Argentina. So do you recruit for that kind of cosmopolitan employee base, or is it by necessity?
The reason we started hiring folks from other places in the world was by necessity. Almost 15 years ago, we couldn't find enough workers to fill essential guest-focused jobs like waiting tables, working in kitchens, cleaning rooms, or even just retail. And so we recruit for skill, and we recruit with two different kinds of international visas, a J-1, which is a student visa. We have a lot of young people from all over Europe and lots of different places around the world. And we have an H-2B visa, which is a more skilled kind of labor, chefs, cooks, professional servers, and those sorts of things. And so with those two recruiting methods, we get a lot of people from all over, and it adds some flavor.
Do some of these employees perform more than one task? We were at breakfast this morning. We thought we were being served by a couple of dancers.
Well, most of our international employees will work in one key job throughout the summer, and they like it because they get lots of time on the job. They have a nice summer income, and then they'll also almost all work at the Medora musical, but not on stage. Almost everybody who works in Medora gets a chance to sell some popcorn, work at concessions, sell tickets, and really that's where the most fun is happening in Medora often, so they really like that.
How many guests do you have here at Medora during a typical season?
Typical season, we see between 115,000 and 120,000 guests at the Medora musical. You'll probably see about 250,000 come through Medora, all said and done, whether you have early season travel for Theodore Roosevelt National Park, September and October golf and park season, folks enjoying the Motahay, camping in the national grasslands. There's really a variety of reasons that people spend time in Medora, but the big draw most of the time, the reason to come today, is the Medora musical.
Now, when Harold Schaefer first envisioned this place back in the early 50s, it was a small, very sleepy town. How many people actually live here year-round as residents of Medora?
Well, we've got about 132 full-time residents here in Medora, and when Harold Schaefer in the early 50s stood up on that big iconic butte just on the east side of town, he looked down on almost nothing, a broken-down old hotel named for Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders, dirt streets, no running water, you know, and he famously kind of murmured to his son Ed, who was a little kid at that point, and he said, "There's too much here to lose." And Ed thought he was crazy. He said, "There's nothing there." And that's one of those stories that gets told over and over again. But it was true. There wasn't anything here. And he just started working and building. And today we have a very, very unique experience that folks from across the world come and say, "Wow, you just cannot find this anywhere else in the world." And that was quite a vision.
Well, the Rough Rider Hotel, which has a lounge and a restaurant. It's very upscale now. It was obviously much ruder then. Is that one of the centerpieces in terms of it having been here in some form from day one?
Yeah, that's one of the most historic places in Medora. It's had a couple different names, the Cosmopolitan. And then after, of course, Teddy's adventures in Cuba, folks in Medora still thought of him as their friend Teddy, and they thought, we need to honor him somehow. So they named it the Rough Riders Hotel, and at that point, it wasn't necessarily something that Teddy himself would have been real proud to direct his friends from out east toward. But his Western friends, he wouldn't shy away from admitting that he had spent time in and around the area. And since then, it's really evolved a lot. It's had a couple of renovations. It's had a whole new tower of rooms added on to it. And as far as luxurious places to stay in Western North Dakota, it's near the top.
Now, we've walked around Medora and seen all these shops selling souvenirs, ice cream is popular, coffee, of course, cafes everywhere. How many of these are individual businesses and how many of them are involved with the foundation?
Well, there's a really good and interesting mix of businesses in Medora. The Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation operates about 30 different businesses, from the big name ones like Bully Pulpit, Medora Musical, Rough Riders Hotel, down to ice cream shops, which, food for thought, Harold's favorite dessert, his favorite little snack was ice cream. So that's one reason there's a ton of it here in Medora. But then you have another mix of local independent business owners in town, good chunk of people, great folks promoting the town and doing a great job with guest experience. You have some state entities there as well, with the Chateau de Mores and the State Historic Society. You have the Cowboy Hall of Fame, another independent group bringing some heritage to life. And then, of course, the National Park folks operating a number of different locations with the Visitor Center. You've got Painted Canyon and the actual entrance to Theodore Roosevelt National Park South Unit. So there's a healthy mix. We operate a good portion here at the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation, but really have fun operating in partnership with locals as well.
And you've got the Billings County Courthouse and a police presence and a fire department. And so there's a lot of cooperation among different organizations.
Yeah, it's not unlike any other municipality in that regard, except for we're all a little closer to each other. You might see the same officer 3-4 times in a day as you pass him, and you wave every time. But it just means that we get to work more closely together and do some really good work worth doing here in Medora.
When you look at the people who do come through here, maybe 250,000 passing through Medora, I suspect because you're in marketing and communications, you're trying to figure out where they're coming from and how many are from North Dakota or how many are from nearby North Dakota. Give us a breakdown of the percentage of people from here, hither and yon.
Sure. So at the Medora Musical, this is North Dakota's show, right? It's something that people are proud of when folks come from out of state and visit their friends and family in North Dakota. One of the things they do is they get to go to the Medora Musical with their relatives. So the majority of Medora Musical attendance is from North Dakota. Everything after that kind of goes in a ranking: Minnesota, South Dakota, Montana, and on down the line. As far as where people from the national park come from, that is a much wider perspective and a little bit harder to track.
Well, eventually there might be another attraction here, the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. What kind of anticipation do you have about that, and what might it do? How might the Medora community change?
Oh, at the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation, we're very excited about the possibility of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library and Museum coming to Medora. It's a big dream, and it's something that I think that Harold Schaefer would have been really excited, two thumbs up about, if he were here today. Theodore Roosevelt loved big things. Harold Schaefer loved doing big things. It's very exciting for Medora to have the one and only Presidential Library for Theodore Roosevelt here in Medora. And there's a lot of work to do to make that dream a reality, but we're here to support our friends at the Library Foundation and do everything we can to help make that a reality.
Is there a timeline you're anticipating? I mean, obviously, the construction has to start, but how do you plan for something like this, a major new asset?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that are happening at once right now, and our friends at the Library Foundation, I think the number one goal for them is probably to raise the rest of the money first. Got to get plans then, of course, and then dealing with the federal government is always something that takes more time than otherwise, and there's lots of good reasons for that. So I think that realistically, most people who have done construction projects, at least of something comparable to this grandeur and this size, are going to say it's going to be a couple of years, which is good. That's good for the community to sort of take the time to have some public input, plan, get some of the infrastructure things rolling, you know, water, sewer, any other road or community-based things that need to happen. We can start that process right now together. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, in 5 years that we're having a conversation about how cool the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library is.
Well, the governor, the legislature, and of course the foundation that you're involved with have all been very upbeat about the potential of this. If you've got 250,000 people coming through Medora, what's the anticipated additional visits by people who go through Medora because they're going to the presidential library, which is very close.
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a lot of smarter people than me who have put their time and effort into estimating those numbers. And I think the key is that no matter what formula we use, it's going to be an estimate, and we'll know when we know. And I think those numbers range from between 50 and 150,000 extra people. And even if it's on the low end of that, that is phenomenal for the state, for Medora. You know, everyone in Medora works hard to see 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 extra people come and enjoy Medora. And there's an economic benefit, but really it's about the image of the state. It's about recruitment. It's about our ability to believe in ourselves. Everybody in North Dakota, after they've spent a little bit of time in Medora, they feel better about being here. You know, you have other things out on the airwaves like the movie Fargo and all the North Dakota jokes, but there really is something remarkable about our state. That's what Teddy Roosevelt experienced. That's why Harold probably never left. And I think everybody feels it when they sort of descend into the Badlands. And so when you start thinking about what is the impact of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library in Medora, yes, it's economic. Yes, it's visitors. Yes, it's great for Medora, Billings County, Western North Dakota, the whole state. But I think it's even bigger for the stuff that you can't measure. It's great for us in our own eyes and in the eyes of the world.
In your business, you look at each visitor as having potential, you know, income for the enterprise. So what is the value of the average visitor to Medora?
Basically, the way we look at it at the TR Medora Foundation is each hotel night brings in about $400 in revenue for the Medora Foundation. That's through a 110-day hotel room rental season. So we're only talking about a third of the potential nights that we could rent. We're a nonprofit, so we're losing a little bit each year because we're reinvesting those monies back into infrastructure that we operate, into offerings for guests, into opportunities for volunteers to come to Medora, student programs, etc. So if you could see the possibilities of doubling, you know, what could happen here in Medora and the investments that could go back into the people and the place, it's really, really exciting. And it's kind of like attendance numbers. You don't know till you know, but the possibilities would just be endless at that point.
I assume that you and this organization work pretty closely with North Dakota Tourism because this is such an important piece of the state's tourism industry.
Yeah, we do. Sarah Audie Coleman and her whole team at North Dakota Tourism, they're just great. They do a wonderful job promoting Medora, the Badlands, the Medora musical, all the unique experiences and the history and culture here. Each year, we work really closely. They've got a big job to promote lots of good things in North Dakota. And so it's fun when they get to spend a little extra time in the Badlands. I think that the opportunity with the Presidential Library to spend more time out here will arise, and we're excited about that too.
You mentioned that we're sitting in the Bill and Jane Marcille Life Skills Center, and those people on the eastern side of the state certainly know the Marcille name. That's Forum Communications Company. He was the former publisher and CEO. Let's talk about the purpose of a building like this, the Life Skills Center. What happens here?
Well, this is the hub of operations for the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation and our 350 to 400 seasonal employees each year, but it's also the hub for 800 volunteers that we have come to Medora each year and spend a week working alongside our seasonal staff, who a lot of times are students or student age. It's also the hub for our full-time staff. It's also the hub for the production team, the cast of the Medora musical, the cast of the Medora Gospel Brunch, the entertainers at the Old Town Hall Theater, and our historic reprisers, Joe Wiegand as, we think, the world's best Theodore Roosevelt. And really, this is the place where everyone comes together and kind of gels. They make it work. And it's called the Life Skills Center because there's a unique experience when you mash all of those personalities up together in one space with one mission to connect people to Medora for positive, life-changing experiences. That just yields this amazing creativity, this energy that you don't get when everyone is spread out and located in their pizza parlor, in their hotel, in their, you know, ice cream parlor or retail outlet. And that's the way it was before this building went up. And so today it's a place where students come together. We have a lot of people who spend their summer in Medora and they're music majors. So there's a place where they can work on their craft, their music. There's a full-size replica of the Burning Hills Amphitheater stage. So before the Life Skills Center, the cast, in a rainy day or a hot day, would practice in a school gymnasium. Well, that's not super conducive, and it takes them off site. So now they're here at the Life Skills Center. They can practice when it's less than ideal outside, midday, before the season really starts, and at the same time mingle with our staff, which, if you're someone answering phones for potential visitors and they're asking you about the show, what better way to know about the show than get to peek in on it a little bit and know some of the performers and get to know it personally and share those stories with a guest calling and thinking about making reservations.
And we're conducting this interview in a place that has a computer lab. It's got some printers and things like that, and we're right next door to what is a little gym. We're hearing people work out. So there's a lot going on here. This particular place is brand new, and it obviously performs a multiple number of functions. But the idea that you could sell an idea like this is interesting to begin with, because this is a concept that you've made very good arguments for it, but if you were talking to a donor, it might be a tough sell.
Well, it can be, and one of the things that I think made sense to the Marseilles is when we started saying, you know what, this isn't just a building. It's not just a copy of a student union on a campus somewhere. It's a life skills center. And what makes it work in Medora and what makes it worthy of a contribution is what happens with the people inside of it. And how do you use the building then to inspire more of that kind of interaction and provide the life skills that a lot of the people who spent a summer in here, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, it makes them remember the summer in Medora as the best summer of their life. We hear it over and over and over again from people who did the most mundane jobs. I wiped the counter at the old Badlands Saloon all summer, and it was the best summer of my life. You don't get that all the time, but it's about connecting with the people that spend a summer in the Badlands. And then it's connecting those people with training and some programming and a chance to continue their education. We're in, right now, the Randy and Lori Hudson-Buehler Resource Room. When we came in, there was one of our student workers taking some online classes. It happens all the time. You have those opportunities for kids from other countries to take English as a second language beginning toward the end of June each year. And you have a chance for, you know, folks to work on their music and their composition in a way that they just can't do getting any summer job at any location. And then they get this sort of learning through osmosis from our volunteers who don't have to be here. They choose to be here. They like to sort of pass on some of their knowledge and help out a little and stay busy. And having those things come together inside this space is what makes it a life skills center. It's what makes the building function for the people, and I think it's what makes it worthy of an investment. And that's what I think the Marseilles saw. It became something bigger than just a place where everyone comes and eats.
You have referred to this in a number of times as a student-centered, this kind of learning environment. Do you have alumni? Do you keep connections with people who have moved on to other things?
You know, unlike a university, we don't have a formal alumni association. We have a whole bunch of really good supporters, really good ambassadors out there. And that's something that in the next few years, we hope to bring everyone together a little bit more. We've had a few cast reunions, and it's been wonderful when it's come together. And in the future, we could see this space being a big part of bringing an alumni association together or an alumni network. Right now, a lot of the people who used to spend a summer in Medora or spent a year working here right out of college and went on to bigger and better things, a lot of times they become annual members of the Medora Foundation, and they get to come to the annual Rough Riders Roundup, see the things that are new, certainly take a tour of this building, and really intermingle with our team. And I think that's probably what they're most excited about. And then they cap it off with seeing the Medora musical.
Well, how did Justin Fisk get here?
Interestingly, my wife has come to the musical almost her entire life. There are fun pictures of her family in the seats in the early 90s, and there's pictures of our family in almost the exact same seats a couple of years ago with our two young children. And it's fun to compare them together. Myself, I hadn't been to the Medora musical till 2010 or 11. She brought me. And I just thought it was wonderful. I always have been attracted to stage entertainment. I thought was very interesting. In high school, I was in DECA, so I got involved in marketing and entertainment productions and things like that at Minot High School. We eventually moved to Bismarck, and I was working in advertising and with the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation, and Mike Bedoin at that time said, you ought to come just work internally for us. I think you'd really like it. And he was right. I've been here ever since and loved every minute of it. And I think my wife is just as excited to get to go to the musical as much as we can.
That was Justin Fisk, the Marketing and Communications Director for Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation. We'll feature another attraction at Medora in an upcoming show. Capitol Gallery West brings the fine arts to an Old West environment, and we'll talk with the man who runs it, David Borlaug, and one of the artists he brought in for a residency, Butch Thunderhawk. Coming up, Natural North Dakota.
Next time on The Pulse, these days pretty much everybody calls addiction a disease.
The disease of addiction.
The disease of addiction.
The ugly disease of addiction.
More specifically, we call it a brain disease. But does that send the wrong message?
Oh, they have a brain disease. Get those zombies away from me. We better lock them up because they can't control their behavior.
We'll explore what we call things and why it matters.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Chuck Lura is a biologist and a naturalist who writes and voices essays about the plants and animals that surround us where we live. Today, his Natural North Dakota essay draws from history to tell a story that continues to amaze. Grasshoppers darken the sun.
I've been reading Military Life in Dakota, the journal of Philippe Regis de Taubrion, published in 1951 by the Alvord Memorial Commission. De Taubrion, a colonel in the Army, was assigned to a post at Fort Stevenson, Dakota Territory, in 1867. Fort Stevenson, of course, was located near the Missouri River, not far from present-day Garrison. He would spend 2.5 years there, and his journal provides an interesting look at life at the post and insight into the natural history of the area, from bison and prairie fires to wild onions and grasshoppers. Yes, grasshoppers. Many among us have heard stories about grasshoppers, but first-hand written accounts are less frequent, although probably more accurate. De Taubrion wrote in his journal during July of 1868 about an incident involving grasshoppers. Here are a few excerpts from his journal entry from July 20th of that summer. Another incident occurred during the day which I cannot leave out here. Around noon, a cloud of grasshoppers began to show up in the sky. A multitude of these fearful insects flew skimming along the ground, and the layers seemed to thicken as they rose in the air. Looked like a little dust of white specks which drifted past each other and multiplied in the air. A great murmur, like the steady rumble of faraway carriages, filled the air all around. Unquote. That wasn't the end of it. Here's some more observations from the next day. The grasshoppers came back. For more than 6 hours they passed over, flying low, many of them almost touching the ground, and all going uniformly from north to south. The flying host swept on relentlessly, flecking the sky like snowflakes driven by the wind. And if one looked at the effect of the wings of these right in the sun, he would have said that it was snowing grasshoppers. It's no exaggeration to say that the sun was darkened by it, while from the air, the great rustling noise I mentioned yesterday came again stronger than ever. Half an hour went by before it cleared. Unquote. That's hard to put into perspective. These grasshoppers may have been a species of locust, which is now extinct, but there are a few grasshoppers that have been known to occasionally have outbreaks of this magnitude. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, a Harvest Public Media report about fattening up seafood with soybeans, followed by another installment of Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom, and our What's Happening calendar of events. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The parents of a State College of Science student who disappeared and was later found dead 5 years ago are appealing the decision of a district judge to dismiss their lawsuit. Andrew Sadek was 20 years old. He had agreed to work as a confidential informant for a drug task force in Wahpeton after he sold a small amount of marijuana. Fargo attorney Tim O'Keefe represents John and Tammy Sadek and is asking the state Supreme Court to review the judge's ruling.
He's saying, we just didn't provide enough evidence. You know, we were saying, judge, there are people tried for murder when they don't find a body. There are circumstantial situations here. There's circumstantial evidence that proves our side, our position in this case of the negligent supervision of Andrew that was done by SEMCA.
The SADCs believe their son was murdered. The case remains open and is still under investigation. Richland County and Sheriff's Deputy are named in the lawsuit. The mining stopped in the mid-90s, but the reclamation work goes on. Knife River Coal continues to work on reclaiming the Gascoyne mine in southwestern North Dakota. It has one permitted parcel left. Public Service Commissioner Randy Chrisman holds the commission's coal reclamation portfolio.
This has taken decades, and while some of these features, these settling features, were tiny, they weren't ignored, and they needed to get in and make sure it was done right, even though mining operations had long since ceased and there were not revenues coming in anymore in order to release themselves from the bonding requirements. They needed to get it done and get it done according to the plan and done correctly. And so they have for decades been held to tough standards. And I think for the long-term, multi-generational good of North Dakota, I think it's a good thing.
North Dakota's reclamation laws are the strictest in the nation. And the State Board of Higher Education has given UND permission to issue up to $80 million in bonds for a new student union. But the actual cost may be less than that. UND students voted to approve the project, with the bond payoff to come from increased student fees. Interim UND President Joshua Wynn had asked the staff to take another look at the proposal because he was concerned about increased student debt load, but he told the board he supports the project.
Even mindful of the changes that are going on in higher education, having a campus that is an attractive environment for interaction among students and with faculty will continue to be important.
UND Vice President for Finance and Operations Jed Shivers says how much can be saved will depend on the final building design.
And we'll see, because, you know, the truth is it's a multi-phase process. So we're just in the design, and from the design comes bids. And I think that's where we'll see whether or not, in fact, we're able to make any material difference in the overall cost of the project.
The board also authorized UND to tear down the existing student union. Shivers says demolition could start within a week's time. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Large barns that dot the landscape across much of the central United States typically house hogs or chickens, animals that eat a lot of soybeans on their way to dinner tables. Someday, that soy protein could be fattening up lots of Midwest seafood. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports.
In this huge greenhouse in central Iowa, blowers move air and water as tilapia swim in tanks. Joe Sweeney is CEO of the fish farm Eagle's Catch. He sells live tilapia to markets in places like New York and Chicago. The farm starts with tiny, nearly translucent tilapia. But they grow fast and efficiently convert their feed into human food.
And when you compare them to other livestock, they're actually getting more protein per pound of feed input than any other animal class.
The fish are hand-fed five times a day, and the tilapia grow from minuscule to 2 pounds in about 9 months. Their high-protein diet relies on soybeans, so you might think that's why Sweeney built his business in an area surrounded by soybean fields. But Sweeney says the commercial fish food he buys comes from the South.
Unfortunately, feeding Louisiana and Arkansas soybeans. But I think as time goes on, I really look forward to being able to feed them that Iowa product.
Globally, aquaculture has huge potential to help meet the needs of a growing population that's eating more protein. But to achieve that, plant proteins will have to take on a greater role. That's because governments restrict harvesting wild fish to feed farmed fish. Iowa State University professor Kurt Rosenstrater has been developing soybean-based fish food.
In Iowa, in particular, we can play a huge role globally in terms of providing protein ingredients for the aquaculture industry.
Rosenstrater has worked with aquaculture projects in Asia, where countries import a lot of U.S. soybeans. More recently, corn protein, a byproduct of ethanol production, is also showing promise.
Many of the biorefineries are taking the next step to produce a more concentrated form of corn protein. And this is one of those things that's really going to be taking the industry by storm the next couple of years.
Across 12 states in the north central part of the U.S., from Ohio to North Dakota to Kansas, hundreds of businesses are trying to grow fish for food. but local demand will have to grow to make them viable.
Diets, in many respects, are cultural based. And so we are, in the Midwest, eating more fish than we used to eat, but still not as much as other parts of the world.
But even here, frozen seafood, often imported, certainly sells. 5 years ago, Julie Taglin and her husband decided to challenge that market. The Forest City, Iowa couple opened an indoor saltwater shrimp farm.
They're Pacific white shrimp. We get them as babies. They're the size of an eyelash.
J&J Dry Dock Shrimp is a direct-to-consumer business that's part of a local foods network.
The majority of our customers, including myself, have never had fresh seafood.
But Taglin says she has a waiting list of customers for the 140 pounds or so of shrimp she harvests every few months. Her shrimp feed comes from a Pennsylvania company that tells her they're working to replace fish meal with more soy protein. And it's not just soy protein. Purdue University fisheries professor Paul Brown says at this point, researchers are looking at what other plant proteins could replace soy.
My goodness, it's lupins, it's peat proteins, it's any potential commodity that can be further processed and into a high-protein ingredient.
Will fish barns or greenhouses someday become another prominent feature of the Midwest landscape? These folks all say maybe, but not immediately. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks at farm and rural issues. Coming up, Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the North Dakota Farmers Market and Growers Association, helping North Dakota farmers, ranchers, and gardeners market their products through farmers markets, grocery stores, and restaurants statewide. Learn more at ndfarmersmarkets.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg in our Fargo studio. In our Bismarck studio, we have root cellar Sue Balcom. It's time for Main Street Eats.
Sue, thanks for joining us today.
I'm so happy to be here.
You want to talk about garlic scapes.
Well, yes, because, you know, it's farmer market season, and it's been a cold, wet spring, and things are not quite there yet to have, like, abundant bunches of vegetables, but you can find garlic scapes because garlic, of course, is planted in the fall, and it is wonderful to be able to use every part of a plant. So I have some recipes for garlic scapes, and I just harvested a whole bunches of them, and now we will wait for our garlic, of course, to come out of the ground. But yeah, while you're waiting for the big vegetables of the year, you should be looking for things like garlic scapes and maybe some young onions and lettuces and peas, because we had such a cold spring, they should be readily available at your market.
Well, when you talk about garlic scapes, I know about the bulbs. That's the part we buy in the store typically. The scape is the stalk? What is it?
Actually, the scape is the garlic thinking that it's time to reproduce. And so it sends up this little shoot in the middle of its stalk, and it kind of makes a curlicue like my hair does when it's really humid outside. And then it has kind of a pointy little thing on the end that looks or resembles an onion when it goes to seed. So in order for you to get good garlic bulbs, you want to absolutely pull those out of your garlic, and pull them out when they're young because they're way more tender. And then you can make some absolutely fabulous things like garlic scape pesto, which one of my favorite things to make in the spring.
So this has the essence of garlic flavor as well?
Yes, but it's a little milder. You can chop it up and use it in stir fries. We kind of like suck on them like a piece of wheat, you know, like you see a farmer stick a piece of wheat in his mouth. Well, we walk around with garlic in our mouths all the time. Keeps the vampires away.
I do that with chives.
Might quell the husband, yeah, too.
Well, you know, they said that nobody associated with those old Germans from Russia because I always smelled like garlic. And so people kind of steered clear of them on the street. Because, you know, actually, if you eat enough, you kind of like sweat that smell right out of your pores. But it's so good for you. Garlic is really, really healthy thing to eat.
I'm pretty convinced in my non-professional, never went to medical school opinion that the amount of garlic I eat and the complete lack of mosquito bothering.
Oh, yeah.
I think so.
well, now would be a good time to start consuming those scapes because the mosquitoes are coming out to roost
and it was
or whatever
so
they do.
Wet. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the pesto. What else can you do with these garlic scapes?
Well, you can make a compound butter, which of course is simply just butter that has been softened, and you can add herbs to it. And so you chop, chop, chop that garlic scape up and you put it in there. And like you said, Doug, it's not as sharp as regular garlic toes are. So you get a mild garlic flavor. If you are stir-frying with it, you want to add tons of it because, you know, when you heat garlic, it loses some of its pungency.
Mm-hmm.
But the garlic pesto, of course, is simply made like basil pesto, only you substitute the garlic scapes for the basil. And you can use sunflower seeds. You know, we talked about sunflowers in North Dakota not too long ago, instead of walnuts if you want to really be local. But hummus, who doesn't love hummus with wonderful chickpeas and garlic scapes? And you can make your hummus like you normally do, and instead of putting in other ingredients like dried tomatoes, you put in your chopped garlic scapes.
I know that I have had garlic scapes before, but not very much. And I'm trying to think, like, texture and consistency. How does it compare to, like, a chive? Is it just a little bit harder?
They are. They're a little bit harder. And it used to be that all of the people – see, one of the things you have to grow up here is hard-neck garlic. The soft neck doesn't grow very well in this colder climate of ours. I wonder if that has anything to do with the people up here now that I think about that. We're all kind of hard necks, aren't we? Anyway, never mind. So we're growing hard neck garlic, and so they are stiffer. But when you cook them, they'll soften up. And I've chopped them up and put them in my sourdough bread before, and they're totally palatable that way.
Mm.
And, of course, you know, when you're making hummus and or garlic scape pesto, you are using your little blender or Cuisinart, and that way you'll get them chopped up really, really fine. They are wonderful. You can make a really nice garlic scape dressing the same way with a little olive oil and vinegar and garlic scapes.
Mm, that sounds delightful.
Oh, God, I'm telling you, I cannot wait. The best thing ever is, like, if you can get a hold of some fresh carrots and use that pesto as a dip for fresh vegetables.
Mm.
Yummy, yummy.
That salad dressing sounds like a really nice way to preserve garlic scapes. What other ideas do you have?
You can actually freeze them. So you can freeze them whole, you know, cut the bottom end off and cut that seed bulb off the top of it and just lay them on a cookie sheet, freeze them, and then throw them in a Ziploc bag. That way you can count how many scapes, you know, like if it says 8 scapes and whatever else, you can pull them out 8 at a time. But I use mine chopped more often than that. So I actually chop mine up, and I always lay my fruits and vegetables on a cookie sheet and freeze them. And then they don't stick together in the bags, and you can remove as much as you need. You can also make garlic scape ice cubes. And you can do this with other herbs, too, that you don't want to ever, of course, preserve garlic in oil in your refrigerator, because that's conditions for things like botulism and other stuff. So you don't want to do that to preserve the garlic. But freezing it's perfectly okay. I've actually dried garlic, you know, chopped up garlic before and preserved it that way. But garlic is an easy plant to... Like, I still have garlic from last year. Like, when the toes are ready and you get them out of the ground at just the right time, they will last for a really long time. But in the spring, when we're anxiously awaiting those fresh fruits and vegetables, garlic scapes are the way to go, and they're good for you.
Sue, have you ever been to Gilroy, California, the capital of garlic in the United States?
No, but they have a big garlic festival don't they? And they put garlic in everything.
I have been there, and the whole town smells like garlic, and you're right. You can buy garlic jelly. You can buy garlic anything.
How about garlic wine? Do they make a garlic wine?
I hope not yet.
Ashley, garlic ice cream.
I was just about to say, I have been told you can make garlic ice cream. I've not tried it. I would totally try that. I'll report back.
Okay, you let me know, because, yeah, I think I'm going to keep mine in my salad instead. So,
well, we've touched on garlic, and, of course, every week we talk with Root Cellar Sue in our Main Street Eat segment here on Main Street about foods that might be in season, might want to take a good look at. So always a pleasure, Sue.
Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure for me to be here also.
What's happening is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Woodhouse Restaurant of Bismarck, a locally owned family restaurant making the American classics from scratch since 1969 and offering homemade soup and pie specials daily.
Well, sing it out because there's a lot going on. It's a beautiful July day and probably lots to happen over the weekend as well because we get busy in the summer.
And here is a very exciting one. The Williston Fly-In this Saturday the 13th at the airport there. This is the fourth annual Williston Fly-In. So airplane rides, aircraft displays, model aircrafts, and just a bunch of equipment and fun things that you can look at or even play with. Is even going to be some inflatable attractions there that you can join in on and laser tag. So the Williston Fly-In, 7 a.m. to noon at the airport there, just off of Highway 2, and it's free.
The North Dakota State Fair gets going later this summer, but in the meantime, you can warm up with some other fairs, including the Red River Valley Fair, which runs today through Sunday in West Fargo at the Red River Valley Fairgrounds. There'll be grandstand shows, a Midway farm equipment and livestock exhibits, unique merchandise, and of course, lots of fair food. The gates open at 8 in the morning. The Midway starts up at 1 o'clock today through Saturday and at noon on Sunday. It costs $10 for adults to get in, $5 for children under 12. The Red River Valley Fair is underway.
Well, fairs and festivals. The North Dakota Renaissance Festival opening day is this Saturday in Regent at the Enchanted Castle. So here you get fire breathers,
yippee,
jousters, food. I mean, have you ever taken a big bite off of one of those honking turkey legs?
I have, but I can't get enough napkins.
Right? Well, then you can have mead, fermented honey drink. That sounds delightful. A lot of artisans and metal foragers doing demonstrations. The festival opens on Saturday in Regent at the Enchanted Castle, 9 to 8. Tickets are $15 for the Renaissance Festival.
Prairie Talks, Mark Twain. We talked with George Frein earlier this week. Well, he appears Sunday in Rugby at the Prairie Village Museum, and it starts at 2 o'clock there. George Frein will portray author Mark Twain in a Chautauqua-style presentation entitled Twain on Humor. Refreshments will be served following the program. As Mark Twain, Frein will talk about the profession and practice of humor. Twain knew a few things about that. Following the monologue, audience members will have a chance to ask Twain questions and express their own opinions about humor. And in the third part of the program, Frein will offer insight and answer questions as a Twain expert and scholar. Incidentally, Frein will also appear in Velva on Monday at 3 o'clock and in Oaks on Thursday at 7. But again, it starts at 2 o'clock Sunday in Rugby at the Prairie Village Museum. And it's free.
It's finally nice enough to start going to some farmers markets as that really summer produce hits the stands. And at the Minot Farmers Market, they're having a special opening scavenger hunt this Saturday the 13th at Oak Park. Again, this is in Minot. So with the official opening of the market season, you can go on a scavenger hunt throughout the market. This is open, well, probably to everyone, but they do say for kids. And you can also, the first 100 people will get a reusable tote bag. Those things are so handy, and you can carry so much more food in a reusable one than the plastic ones from the store. So check this out, the opening day of the Minot Farmers Market this Saturday at Oak Park, 9 to noon. Entry is free, and after that, whatever you spend is supporting local growers.
Well, let's keep on the food kick here, where the Prairie Roots Food Co-op will celebrate an anniversary this evening in Fargo. It'll happen east of the co-op and Wild Terra, a meadery, speaking of mead as we did earlier, along 12th Street North in Fargo. Prairie Roots Food Co-op invites the community to celebrate with them. This event marks 2 years of operation. This is a family-friendly event, includes everything from a live DJ to free caricatures. It will run from 5 until 8 p.m. Doesn't cost anything to get in. And again, it's the Prairie Roots Food Co-op. Of course, there are members, but this is open to everybody. So take it in.
Happy birthday, Prairie Roots. The Rain Gutter Regatta this Saturday in Detroit Lake. So hoist your mainsail for this event meeting at the Becker County Museum, where you can do a boat building excursion. I'm told it's good enough for Captain Ahab himself. And boy, did that man know his knots. So if it's good enough for him, you can go and build your own boat. And then you get to race it in a specially built gutter water track. So this Saturday in Detroit Lakes at the Becker County Museum at 10 to noon. Tickets are just $5.
Saturday is Sodbuster Day at Fort Ransom State Park. That's located 2 miles north of the town of Fort Ransom. You can experience turn-of-the-century farm and homemaking demonstrations at the annual Sodbuster Days at Fort Ransom State Park. There will be old-time music, a wheelwright demonstration, a parade, a horse-powered threshing and haying demo. Food and beverages will be available for purchase. It will run from 10 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, again on Saturday at Fort Ransom State Park. It costs $10 to get in if you're an adult, 12 and under, free. Sodbuster Day. Sounds like fun.
All right. I love this one. Halloween in July on a Saturday at Turtle River State Park. One, because you can actually likely be whatever you want for Halloween and not just whatever is warm enough to go trick-or-treating. And two, you can go out a little bit later because the sunshine is going to be there. So this is a family-friendly night of fun costumes and decorations. There's going to be ghoul and goblin games, a contest for the best costume, trick-or-treating, of course, and scary movies. Bring the whole family to this spooktacular summer event. It goes from 10 a.m. to 11:30, Halloween in July at Turtle River State Park, and it's free.
Here's one called Wine Class, Just Trust Me, Saturday in Moorhead at Bridgeview Liquors. When you find a wine or type of wine you like, it can be easy to stick to it and not to explore wines which are unfamiliar, especially if they're made with grapes you've never heard of and come from unfamiliar places. Well, this class will explore unique, obscure, and experimental wines. It will run from 1 till 2 in the afternoon on Saturday, again at Bridgeview Liquors in Moorhead, and it costs $20. What's your pick this week?
The Golden Girls Crafternoon. This is Friday the 12th in Grand Forks at Archives Coffee House. Those Golden Girls are a delightful group of rabble-rousers here. So there's going to be some Golden Girls trivia and endless discussion if you are a Sophia or a Rose or a Blanche. And I'm sure there better be cheesecake. I'm reading through this, and I have seen enough Golden Girls to know that if you're going to do a Golden Girls Crafternoon, there better be cheesecake. So Friday the 12th in Grand Forks at Archives Coffee House, 4 to 6 p.m., and it's $25. And, of course, there is some crafting. You will get to make a necklace or wall hanging.
The Red River Market is my pick because it opens for the season this Saturday in Fargo, downtown in the parking lots just south of the Forum Building. Fargo-Moorhead's largest farmers market opens for the season. The market provides access to sustainably grown local food and food products in the Fargo-Moorhead metro area and beyond, and its vendors also include unique creations by local artisans. The Red River Market will run Saturdays through late October. It runs from 10 in the morning until 2 o'clock on Saturday, and it costs whatever you buy. And that's what's happening.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 11th. The most despised insect in North Dakota has been the mosquito. Always humming in your ear, with bites so itchy and painful, you slap yourself to kill one. One tale suggested that Dakota mosquitoes were especially unbearable because they had been crossbred with wasps. How did North Dakota fight mosquitoes in the past? There were four ways. A person could use a head net, a smudge, stay inside, or get used to it. At Fort Buford in 1877, every officer and soldier had to wear a close-fitting head net, and 100 smudge fires were used to envelop the fort with smoke. Despite these measures, there was no sleep or rest for the men, and some were nearly crazed by the torture. The smoke from the smudge fires came from throwing damp hay or straw or green wood or green grass on the fires so that mosquitoes would stay outside the radius of the smoke. But perhaps the best method of avoiding mosquitoes and their bites involved staying inside in the evening hours, but that required having tight-fitting window screens and effective screen doors. But no matter how hard anyone tried to keep them out, mosquitoes came buzzing through the twilight air to become the sleep-destroying bloodsuckers inside bedrooms. It was on this date in 1913 that the Bismarck Tribune published an article entitled How to Fight the Mosquito, advising that mosquitoes could be kept away from porch or sleeping rooms by using a few drops of eucalyptus oil sprinkled on a cloth, or citronella oil mixed with oil of cedar and spirits of camphor. Some U.S. government experts advised in 1901 that chlorine gas, by mixing 5 spoonfuls of chloride of lime with 10 cubic centimeters of crude sulfuric acid on a dinner plate, would eliminate mosquitoes in a house. These poison fumes, later dreadfully used in World War I, were to be put only in rooms not inhabited. More sensibly, homeowners burned pyrethrum powder made from chrysanthemum flowers, which could kill mosquitoes, or at least stupefy them. In the 1950s, towns and cities across the state sprayed themselves with DDT insecticide and fuel oil, which was effective, but the DDT killed almost all living things. The never-ending war against Dakota mosquitoes continues with backyard bug zappers, DEET repellent, and aerial spraying. But even today, we still say, get used to it. The only victory comes in icy winter time. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
NASA is spending billions to build the most powerful rocket ever made.
It's going to house 537,000 gallons of liquid hydrogen.
But will it fly enough to justify the massive price tag?
Any architecture for going back to the moon and going to Mars using it will be strapped by the cost.
Deep pockets for one big rocket on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll preview this Sunday's episode of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life with host Jack Russell Weinstein. Jack's guest this month is philosophy professor Christina Bicchieri. Their topic is, can we change social norms? Tom Eason will share a Plainsfolk essay. News director Dave Thompson will talk about the week's big stories. And Madeline will review Spider-Man, Far From Home. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.